The guy who's trying to make androids more lovable.
He is trying to capture something that's a lot more ineffable, which is humanness. Should I trust this other being in the room?
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace Tech. I'm Molly Wood. Ever since we first imagined robots, we have imagined robots who look like humans, or androids. In Japan, there's an artist and inventor who has been fascinated with them. Hiroshi Ishiguro has created about 30 realistic androids at his research lab at Osaka University, and he studies how humans interact with them. Alex Marr is a documentary filmmaker who wrote about his work for Wired magazine.
I mean, Hiroshi is... he's a little bit of a rock star, I have to say, for the robotics industry. And he started out in the visual arts, but he also, even today, thinks of himself as more of an artist than a roboticist. And at this point, he's one of the most exciting and original thinkers and designers in android science.
Do the androids that he's building, do they have brains? You know, what is the level of interaction?
Well, they don't have actual brains, Molly, because would be living in a very different world if that were true. But, at this point, he has androids that are able to have a pretty good interactive conversation with anyone. I mean, they're operating with very advanced chatbots. But Hiroshi's specialty is he is trying to capture something that's a lot more ineffable, which is humanness, right? And I think it's at the root of a lot of our suspicions about robotics and the possibility of a convincing android. Should I trust this other being in the room? Is it human-like mm-hmm. enough?
Hiroshi seems particularly interested in creating androids that look like women. His first attempt was actually his daughter, but since then he's replicated, for example, a newscaster who's well known in Japan. Why do you think that is, and how did it make you feel?
This points to a larger question about technology and research and development in general. You know, who's doing the research? Who's propelling it forward? Who are they assuming is the audience? And, you know, it's a male-driven industry. And I think, you know, Hiroshi is playing to what he presumes the audience is. And that's also an extension, perhaps, of Japanese culture. A lot of visible people in more kind of support positions and in the service industry are female. One of his ideas is that, you know, an android could replace receptionists across the country in Japan. They can become a replacement newscaster. So, I mean, you should maybe be concerned if he moves to the States. But and his assumption is that that would be absolutely ideal, because who wants to deal with a male robot or an unattractive robot when you can deal with an attractive female? And of course, that opens up a whole other can of worms that's problematic.
Yeah. It's interesting because I just saw the Blade Runner 2049 movie, and I came away thinking that this is almost like these androids, that this is a beautiful and phenomenal and technologically advanced product that clearly was created with the assumption that no woman would ever watch it. It's like it didn't even occur to them.
Well, I haven't seen the new Blade Runner, but it's funny because I do tip the hat to the original Blade Runner in this piece, because Hiroshi himself brought it up.
Yeah.
We were driving late at night in his very slick black Mazda. He also has an all-black Porsche. He's very obsessed with black. And he, out of the blue, seemingly just brought up Blade Runner and said, you know, you remind me of the replicant in Blade Runner. And he was referring to Sean Young. And so it led to a conversation about, you know, wouldn't it be funny if, you know, you went back to the States and, you know, people thought I had made a copy of you, right? We'd made your replicant. And it's really, you know, at this point, he has probably about 24 female androids. They're all meant to look like 20-something attractive females. And again, he, as their creator, is making decisions as to what an attractive female is. And I think, you know, one of the things that's really fascinating is all of this work started with, as you mentioned, his very first android experiment, which was actually of his 5-year-old daughter. So a very different kind of female, right? And I then eventually got to meet her, and now, you know, a grown woman. When I met her, she was 19, and to talk to her about that experience And it was really fascinating and kind of satisfying to see that she does not fit into any of her father's ideas of what the ultimate female might be. She is opinionated and incredibly smart, very ambitious academically, and, you know, had nothing in common with this sort of idea of like a glamorous female you might want to replicate.
While a lot of your article really seems to be dealing with the sort of question of intimacy, what it means and how it happens and why it happens. And you write about how while you were in Japan, you began a new relationship with a human. Tell me about that juxtaposition.
Hopefully with a human.
With a human. You know, I mean, at this point in the future that we live in, it seems important to clarify.
Thanks, but, yes.
Well, how did that make you think about intimacy and what that means?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's an unusual choice to introduce the first person in a story like this. I set out to write a very intimate profile of a particular person and his work, but Hiroshi's work is so much about, you know, is it possible to replicate human intimacy? What is human intimacy? What is that sense of human connection? And while I was in Japan, by coincidence, I ended up meeting someone and becoming romantically involved with him over the weeks that I spent doing this research. And it really set up a very stark contrast. I mean, I was spending my days in multiple Android labs, you know, watching people interact with these robots that are covered in a very convincing silicone skin. And, you know, these robots are being programmed to tilt their heads in a very touching way, to blink at the right intervals, to really look like they are sympathetic towards you. And having conversations with Hiroshi and his colleagues about, you know, how you can break down and all of those kinds of cues that make you feel like you're in an intimate situation. And I guess I hadn't really realized how that was having an impact on me. It was a little bit chilling, quite frankly, because Hiroshi is really interested in how can we manipulate. How can he manipulate human beings through his work? That to be able to really convince you to have a kind of affectionate relationship with one of his machines would mean that he has succeeded, right? And so to meet someone, a human, as you pointed out, who stirred in me just a really immediate sense of physical attraction and a desire to be with him, to have long conversations late at night, and it just felt very uncontrived and instinctive, and it was a huge relief to me, quite frankly, that something like that is still possible, even when we're living at a time when people are doing this kind of research, trying to break human relationships down to a science.
Well, and so many of us do use smartphones and technology for comfort and entertainment and to avoid loneliness. Things that we might also turn to our intimate partners for, or instead of intimate partners. Was part of that sort of chilling feeling looking at these machines, these androids, and thinking maybe that could happen? These could play that role for us?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm a real believer in humans over machines. So I really do believe in, you know, some sort of human soul that can't be replicated. But in the process of doing this research, I was really forced to confront the fact that so many of our relationships at this point are through social media, through late night text messages, what have you. We all have relationships at this point where we never see the other person in person. Right. And so physical embodiment is becoming almost less necessary to some of the important professional and personal relationships that we all have. So, as I raise in the story that, you know, are you really sure that you would instantly realize if a chatbot took over the text messaging you got from your closest friend? I'm not convinced of that. And the other part of it, too, is one of Hiroshi's strangest androids is a toddler-sized robot called the Telenoid that is a little more abstract. It doesn't have hands. It doesn't have legs. It's bald, and it's all white. But it has these an incredible range of facial expressions, and it speaks in this very lilting kind of way. It tilts its head, and you know, you can hold it very comfortably, and it's sort of warm to the touch. And this thing that looks actually quite terrifying in photographs, when you pick it up and interact with it, and when someone remotely operates it from another room and speaks to you through it while you're holding it, I mean, you could sit and interact with this thing for a long time. It really was a sympathetic creature to have in the room. And it's a robot that's being used in a lot of senior centers in Japan right now and for the last several years as an experiment to see, you know, what can you do about elderly people who don't have many family members visiting them, who are very much alone. And it's a very chilling solution potentially, but I saw a lot of video footage of elderly people in these centers using these strange telenoids, and they looked comforted as if, you know, in a similar way as if like a human being were sitting across from them holding their hand and having a conversation. So this is something that we really need to take seriously, and I think it raises some very big kind of frightening questions.
And do you think that did you come away thinking that there may be some things that robots will be able to do that humans cannot?
I mean, I think that there is a kind of consistency of personality and appearance that humans don't really have. I mean, we have our habits and, you know, there's that saying that you can't really change someone. But that's not really true. We grow and we evolve over time. And we certainly age, right? And our opinions and our affections fluctuate. And that's part of the pain and the excitement of being human and having human relationships. But if you are someone who finds that intimidating and who prizes above all else a relationship or a friendship with someone whose opinions are completely predictable, whose jokes are completely predictable, whose appearance you can design and dictate, who will never grow old or sick, then I think, you know, an android relationship might be the solution.
Alex Marr wrote Love in the Time of Robots for Wired magazine. I would just like to say for the record, though, that at least for the moment, I think I'm still better than the best chatbot, I think. But my conversation with Alex was fascinating. We talked about how men respond to Hiroshi's female robots and so much more. Could you fall in love with a robot? Email us at mptech@marketplace.org and let us know. I'm Molly Wood. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.